Now, the Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to the second half of the Interpreter Foundation radio broadcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson with my co-hosts John Gee and Kevin Christensen.
Good evening. Good
evening. Kevin?
Good evening.
And just wanted to welcome you back for this next two segments of the program. Our first segment is going to be a discussion on archaeology in North America and Mesoamerica, particularly, I think, as it applies to the Book of Mormon. And then the second half hour is going to be an interview with S. Kent Brown on his new BYU New Testament commentary volume, The Epistle to the Ephesians, which is out in electronic version, but the hardbacks are still wending their way. They probably won't make it before Christmas. I understand they'll be here about first week of January or so. But that's a project we'll talk more about in that hour. And I have a confession to make. I am extremely well-read on a lot of topics. But several years ago, after I read An Ancient American Setting for the Book of Mormon by John Sorensen, which came out, I think, in the late 80s, and Warfare in the Book of Mormon, edited by Bill Hamlin, also from Farms, coming out in the late 80s, I really have not paid that much interest to Book of Mormon geography.
Or archaeology.
As I mentioned in the previous hour, I love the scriptures and I love doctrine. And frankly, those are areas where my eyes kind of glaze over. And Kevin, you're going to have to convince me of some things. However, in preparing for this segment, I pulled a couple of books off my shelf and I think I'm going to have to go back and reevaluate it. Not because I want to subscribe to one theory or the other, but simply because there is a lot more there that I missed, and maybe now I'm more mature. I don't know. We'll have to see.
Well, okay, so I'm actually on an archaeological dig. I do work with archaeological evidence, so I'm somewhat versed in this, even though I mainly work in Egypt. But some of the archaeological processes, techniques, advantages and disadvantages show up there, and I have been on a Mesoamerican dig, but that was years ago and not as an active participant, and merely as an observer.
I think that's about where I would go. So, Kevin, you have a little more of an interest in this, so give us an overview a little bit about where we stand with Book of Mormon archaeology.
Well, as we stand with Book of Mormon archaeology, is that wisely, I think, as far as the church is concerned, there is no official position on exactly where things took place. They're just leaving it up to us to discuss things and to do so seeking out of the best books words of wisdom, which I think is a good thing. And you mentioned John Sorensen's 1985 book, An Ancient American Setting for the Book of Mormon. And that one was a classic, a breakthrough thing. For me, before then, everything that I'd got through CES or Deseret Book was kind of vague. And we'd watch, you know, little videos, Meet the Mormons or Christ in America, or, you know, when they chose some metal plates from various places and they talk about Quetzalcoatl. But since then, in the wake of Sorensen's book, there's been a number of people like Brant Gardner and that's taken things. I've got a book up here called Geology of the Book of Mormon by Jerry Grover, where he looks at the implications of the descriptions, especially of the destructions in 3rd Nephi, and where that could plausibly fit. there's been several trained Mesoamericanists, people like John Clark, who, while not advocating any particular view, he's been doing, started in the Farms Review, in the very first issue of the Farms Review, in fact, started doing, going through the Book of Mormon itself and saying, okay, these are the things that any model that is proposed has to account for. And then over a number of years, I think he looked at least, probably at least a dozen different models, comparing them against the text of the Book of Mormon. And quite consistently, it turned out that Sorensen's model was the one that looks best. And then there have been some important revisions to Sorensen's model from 1985, the most important ones having to do with Mesoamerican directions, which both Brent Gardner and Larry Polson came up with. Then, pointed out that in Mesoamerica, in ancient Mesoamerica, they didn't think of directions in a vertical cross like we do with north, straight north, and, straight overhead, at 90 degree angle from where you're standing, but rather, with following sunrise and sunset, so that there are quadrants. There's a northern quadrant, an eastern quadrant, a southern quadrant, and a western quadrant, and that they're not exactly proportional because of the way that the sun moves, during the year. So applying that sort of thing to Sorensen's model, I think actually strengthens the case. And there are other people with Mesoamerican qualifications like Mark Wright and Brant Gardner and a few others that have published important things. And most importantly, there was a revolution in Mesoamerican studies a few years ago when there's a National Geographic special about this thing called LIDAR, where they fly an aircraft over the jungle and they shoot laser pulses down into it and measure the speed of the reflections coming back. And
that was the most fascinating special. I found that on Disney Plus, which I never watch.
Yes.
I rarely watch anything. And it was amazing.
It might be worth doing. I Steve Houston gave a presentation on that, and he says it has an advantage and a disadvantage. On the one hand, they can see all this stuff and where buildings were that they didn't know existed. On the other hand, they hesitate to make the information public because the looters will know where they are, and the looters can get to it faster than the archaeologists can. So it's illustrated just how little of Mesoamerica has been excavated. And one of the things that you were right to point out, Kevin, that there's a connection between the geography and the archaeology. If you don't know where it's located, you can't dig in the right spot. And I'll use an old world example of that, and that is the capital of the Mitanni Empire is Washukani. We have no idea where it is. We have some general ideas, but how can you go digging at for the capital of the Mitanni Empire if you don't know where you're to dig?
Well, there is a new Indiana Jones movie coming out. I think it'll be in there, John.
I'm still looking for the Delta site where they drove the car off the cliff. I can't find any cliffs in the Delta.
I'm trying to hunt down that government warehouse where the Ark of the Covenant is.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's part of the – so you have to dig in the right spot. But even if you dig in the right spot, there's certain advantages and disadvantages of – how archaeology works and how it interacts with texts, because the text will sometimes tell you things that you don't have archaeological evidence for, and vice versa. And archaeology is really good for finding out general patterns like settlement and what the poor people are up to that usually don't make it into the text, but doesn't work well often for finding certain specific things that are mentioned in the text. they can overlap, and then there are lots of areas where they don't. And so you need to have some skill in recognizing what you're looking at. Give you the example of, say, animal bones. So most – it's only been in the last, maybe about 30, 40 years where they even paid attention to animal bones that were found on site. But they also – oftentimes the animal bones will be used or buried or disposed of on site. But most animal bones aren't. So you don't bury your animals in the middle of the city. You take them elsewhere. And it won't tell you about things. The one example I used to think of is when I was going to school in New Haven. In the summer, the police would often show up on the streets on horses. And how would you find out archaeologically if they used police used horses in New Haven? Because that's something I observed. But if the horse dies, they're not going to leave it on the street. They're going to cart it out of town.
Paid anyway.
Right. And so it's not going to be left around. How are you going to prove archaeologically that there were horses used by the police in New Haven? That's going to be difficult to do because they're not going to leave the horse bones in New Haven for the archaeologists to find. And it's the same way with the animal disposal in ancient times. They typically don't do it on the site. And the same way with even dead bodies. They don't – somebody who lives in a house usually isn't buried in the house. There are a few cultures that do that. But most cultures, you don't bury them where the people living. They're, right. And so
– or they build a pyramid.
Right. So one of the problems we have with our site in Egypt is we've got this huge cemetery, but where did the people live? Where are these people coming from? They didn't live in the cemetery.
But you don't have an adjoining settlement site that they've found.
No, the nearest settlement sites we know of are miles away. And which direction should we go? So this is one of the problems that you – archaeology has certain advantages and it has certain problems, but oftentimes you can't find things. And it's not like there are not disagreements. So I'll give you the example, you know, if you'd of the Exodus. There were lots of scholars who say, well, there's no archaeological evidence for the Exodus. Yet the arguably one of the best Egyptian archaeologist or archaeologist who digs in Egypt is Montford Bitok, and he argues that there is evidence.
Reminds me, I have to return that book to you someday.
Well, and he was willing to make the argument both in English and in German. So the German publication is on the way to me, and I heard him give it. But he's willing to argue that there is archaeological evidence for the Exodus, and I've heard text scholars say there isn't. So, but a lot of it depends on what counts. And so, and another part is just keeping up with things. For example, just this year we have new evidence for horses in the Americas in Book of Mormon times, and that was just this year. So the argument that they haven't found something, the usual way to express that is
– we haven't found it yet.
Well,
or
that absence of evidence doesn't mean evidence of absence.
Mm-hmm.
Only a small – archaeology takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, and to do just a small area. And to excavate anything on the order that you would need to say, well, we don't seem to find that here, and there may be reasons for that.
As Kevin was mentioning, about 90% of it is still buried, and it would take an astronomical amount in Mesoamerica. Would you say it's higher than that?
The evidence is higher than 90% hasn't been excavated. It's such a small percentage. It's
yeah, well,
and this is anywhere across the globe.
Mm-hmm. Kevin?
Yeah, so you know, just think about the kind of revolution that the litter caused. And that's only been 3 years or so since that special came out, and it was revolutionary. I think Brant Gardner in around 2005 or 10 or something, around when his six-volume commentary was coming out, I heard him comment. He said that the information necessary to test the Book of Mormon against Mesoamerica, or really anywhere in America, if you're he says it only come out in the past 30 years. So the people before that, even doing the best they could, simply did not have the right information available. So there has to be some self-reflection to start. You know, when Jesus talks about, says you start, for your judgment has to start with taking the beam out of your own eye. You don't start out by thinking, I will never see more clearly than I do now. You know, that's going to lead to trouble. You know, you have to be self-reflective. How much do I know? How much do I not know?
Yeah, if you're never going to, well, if it's never going to be clearer than it is to you now, then it's going downhill, and you're not going to learn anything more. A friend of our family's went and. When one of his sons turned 16, he went into his room and says, well, how does it feel that you know more now than you will ever know? You're as smart as you'll ever be right now.
Yeah. So one of the things that people ask me about, Kevin, is DNA. And I've always been a bit skeptical about that. Basically, it's like, okay, we didn't find it, but as John was indicating earlier, absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. And I've never thought that all the people here on the American continent descended from Lehi and Nephi. I just felt that was a very small group, and it was mostly assimilated.
Well, and even the Book of Mormon, the Mulekites didn't descend from Lehi.
Right.
And part of the... I remember when the DNA things first came out, and things have changed since then, but they were saying, well, we don't find any Middle Eastern DNA in the Americas. Well, what is Middle Eastern DNA? And they'd sampled almost nobody from the Middle East at all at that time. And what do we do with people who move? After all, Hungary was established by the Huns, who came from Central Asia. You know, what – and is modern Hungary, how much of that Hun DNA has been
– I could ask my daughter. She just got back.
versus the Europeans. So people move, and that changes things, but how do you know what you're looking for on the DNA? How do you know that you've the DNA experts like John Butler and Michael Whiting said, well, you've got all these problems with the whole setup. You have bottlenecks. You have all of these other things, for example, and refer you to Michael Whiting's publications on that, because he explains it fairly clearly. But there are all kinds of problems with some of these statements that have been made about the use of DNA in the Book of Mormon, is because I'm a little bit too skeptical on how you can determine somebody's origins, where they came from their DNA, which doesn't encode geographic information.
So
there's that really good collection of book of the DNA essays called The Book of Mormon and DNA Research that Daniel Peterson edited, that's still very good. That really shows the whole shape of the thing, not only from the perspective of people who actually hold patents in the testing, you know, like Whiting and Butler, that really know their stuff, but also just going back and looking at the test and asking ourselves, what should I expect? You know, not just thinking, well, it's not what I expected, but then that's always an opportunity to step back, examine the beam in your own eye. What should I expect? And then go back and look at the text and, you know, start to notice things in the text that really only make sense if you're thinking, yeah, that there were other people here when they got here, and that that's going to account for a lot of the things that they say and do, and why they say and do what they do, and why they use language like the people of Nephi, and why they talk about adoption of the Gentiles into the covenant, and you know, there's just all sorts of things that if you're willing to see it, it's there, and then that changes your expectation so that the whole thing becomes, you know, far less of an issue than it is to somebody who expects, well, we should have it all in the bank. It should just be what, you know, what my most naive expectations are. And those are the people that get in the most trouble with this sort of thing. And that's the kind of surfacey argument that gets exploited by the people who want to just have a little soundbite that they can use to, you know, leverage your faith out.
Well, you know, Kevin, in the last few minutes that we have, I had an experience, and I'm sure you have too, where you run across something and all of a sudden it makes you shake your head and you have to stop and regroup. And then you just look at it and it, you've talked about it in some of your writings as a paradigm shift. Tell us a little bit about how you deal with that and some of these kind of issues where, yeah, there's new stuff coming out all the time. Positive, but somehow people keep reinventing the wheel and trying to bring up the old, same old arguments, and yet somehow they still keep working because sometimes people don't know how to adjust their paradigm. What kind of advice would you give them?
Oh, well, just, you know, start with that thing that Jesus said, check your own eye for beams, and that means you've got to examine your own assumptions. And some of that, you know, for myself, I can just look at lots of them. But, you know, for me, reading Sorensen's Ancient American Setting in 1985 was a massive paradigm shift. It just changed the way that I see. And then since then, there have been other things. He did his other book, Mormon's Codex. It's more like a high-def version of the thing. And there's been some people like Larry Polson and Brant Gardner that have kind of improved and refined certain aspects of it. You know, the idea that there's more to learn, and that if, you know, if I read a critic saying, well, there wasn't iron, well, try Googling Olmec iron and see what comes up. And you find out that even somebody like Michael Coe, who was a Mesoamericanist and who's on a number of occasions been called on to criticize the Book of Mormon claims, when you look at what he said he hasn't been keeping up. You know, and he's been retired as a Mesoamericanist, and a lot's happened since he was active. And I've noticed things that you would expect him to know, he doesn't. You know, it's all right to read him, but just don't stop there, because we have our own experts too. And there's, you know, people like Sorensen and Mark Wright and Brant Gardner and several others, Diane Worth, that know their stuff. John Clark, and you know, if you're really serious about proving the contrary, as Joseph Smith said, then you wrestle with the arguments on both sides, and that process is going to open up your mind, and you'll realize there's more to see than I have seen before. And then you go back and you read the Book of Mormon with fresh eyes, and you start to see, this works. This makes more sense. In fact, this is quite remarkable. And then you watch the literary thing, and that's astonishing, because there's so much in there, and you know, it's not addressed to us when we watch it. You know, it's not addressed to the LDS, certainly, when you watch it on the Disney Channel, but there's stuff in there that just is climbing out of the pages of Helaman and Third Nephi. It's pretty amazing.
Thank you, Kevin. That wraps up our discussion for this evening about these kind of matters, and just stay tuned to Interpreter Radio every week, because our rotating series of co-hosts will have different assignments in order to talk about things like this and be able to provide helpful information on various topics that people may have questions about.